Okay, so
just a reminder, I promise that to do tomorrow.
I guess I was in a perversely mean mood when I got the syllabus or something. Well, not that mean, because I still left the drop in there, but I did have it due at 7 in the morning or something. The thought process was, usually I was having it do at the end of class, I decided to make a law first. I was sort of thinking, well, normally I have to do on Thursday. So in saying 7 in the morning, I was sort of thinking that was cutting into a break, but I needed to do it late Thursday night. Stopped really realizing that a lot of you have been good at 7 in the morning. So now I realize that the noon is a little bit more convenient. So we'll just change that to noon because we can. But as of 12:01, if the TA happens, if the TA hasn't been by, who's the wiser if you stick it in the box? I don't care if it shows up at 12:30. But the TA will have license to come by starting at like 12:01. And if the papers are gone, I don't want to hear about it. Okay? That's why I have the drops in there, so I don't have to hear about it. Because there are 220 of you and there's one of me. So, alright. And it's a small thing. I know it's like, oh, this is the only ones that are happening to me, but that's like 10% of the class every time. So that's 20 emails every Friday. So that's why I have the rule. Handing back problem sets. I know some of you have emailed me, some of you like to take your solutions to the problem sets and look over the solutions after you get them back. I think that's a good practice. I have no problem with that. And we will try to get them back typically sometime early-ish the following week after you hand it on Friday. That didn't happen this time because we're still sort of getting organized. One of the delays has been the fact that what I used to do is I just used to have folders that basically were alphabetized by first letter, last name, and I put it in a box outside my office door, and you could just kind of pick up your paper whenever you wanted. But somebody got pretty strung out about the fact that somebody else might see their grade and complain to deans, and so the deans sent changed the policy or the reminders of the policy that you basically have to have anything that's handed back to you completely private. Which, okay, but now I can't do the sort of box thing very easily. So I've been pondering what to do for that. So for the exams, what we'll do is we'll literally take envelopes and put your exam in there, seal it, and put a name on it. So it adds an hour or two to TA time, but that way you can still pick it up. I'll hand them back in class, but you can do that. I don't hand them back in sections because I know for a fact that you may not always go to your section. You may go to other sections, or you may not make it. So if we hand them back in sections, we'll still have about a 30% level people who haven't picked up their stuff. So I still sort of like to have the box idea so you can pick it up at your convenience. So we'll do envelopes for the problems, for the exam. I'm not going to do that for problem sets. That's just an enormous amount of work and a lot of sort of waste of kids' time rather than spend their time doing office hours and workshop contact hours with you. So what we're probably going to do for that is I've asked the TA to just circle the problem that they basically are assessing. There'll be no grade on your problem set at all when you get it back. Okay? There may be a mark if you have a big blank space to make the line through it or something. If you didn't do the problem, you won't find something circled. But whether you see something circled or not, whether they've assessed it as a reasonable effort or not, they're meant to be pretty generous, okay? But whether they do or not, you have to go to Blackboard to see. If you have nothing or zero for that particular one, then it means you didn't get it. And if they have a one there, it means you did. If you have issues with that, you bring it to me, okay? So we'll probably do it that way. And then the homeworks will be put back in folders, alphabetized by first letter, last name. I may occasionally bring them to class, but basically they'll be outside my office door. And you can just pick them up at your convenience. Is that okay? All right. I actually looked into a few other ways. If some other class is doing this in a much smarter way, let me know. I'm not sure. I went to Office Depot and tried some ideas. I was looking to see if we could do like like a lottery ticket. You can scratch it off and see if you won. The people at Office Depot look like having like I've just been smoking something, so they didn't have it. I will hassle my TAs and get some office hours set up, I hope starting next week, so we'll have office hours scheduled for the week. So basically, they'll be sitting somewhere that will be different for each one. They'll be doing their homework or something unless you walk in. If you walk in and have some random question about physics stuff, they'll stop what they're doing and try to help you out. Workshops begin next week. I want to talk to you a moment about your expectations. My guess is that almost all of you, unless you're a transfer student, have been through basically what we call workshops, mostly in chemistry or biology. Generally, those are run pretty well, so I'm assuming that you all are experienced and know how to make a physics workshop work. But let me just quickly remind you what it's all about. I do get highly amused sometimes. We'll have a mid-semester TA evaluation. And inevitably, when I read those for my TAs, you'll get the ones that say, I hate my TA. He doesn't tell me the answer. And so when I tell the TAs their evaluations, and some of them will get rated very low because they're not giving the answer. I'm like, that's just, you're doing your job. So what I tell the TAs is their job is to facilitate you doing the problem. Okay? I know they can do it, and if they go up and they do the problems for you in front of you at the board, and explain it beautifully to you, you will walk out of there feeling warm and fuzzy about it. You'll be very happy. You'll think they're great. And you won't have learned much at all. Because when I put an exam problem in front of you, and you don't have a TA in front of you telling you the story, you really won't know how to do it. And I'm sorry about that, but it is true that really the only way you learn is when you engage and do it. And that's what the whole workshop is about. So I will tell the TAs that if they look expectantly at you, expecting you to do the problem, you should go get a coat. Because it's really just there for you. I do keep track of attendance because I want to be able to have some measure of effort, but I'm not really... That's a hairline grade thing. Okay? I want you to go and I want you to engage. If you're not engaging and you're not asking questions, you're really frittering away my best way to help you help yourself. Okay? Now, I do understand it's a pretty random selection as to who ends up in what section. So if you're in some section where somebody likes to just blurt out their strategy or answer very quickly because they have something to prove to themselves or to you or whatever, that breaks the workshop because you don't have a chance to think. So please, if you're one of those people, don't blurt out the answers. Okay, give everybody a chance to think, and then let's discuss the strategy. But if you're in a section where somebody does that all the time and you can't chill it out, well, my TAs will be under instruction to talk to them. But there are other examples. Suppose you're in a section where you have 9 people who are really pretty quick at this stuff and you find you're really slow, so you actually don't want to ask your question. Or you're one in the workshop where you're the quickest in there and everybody else is so slow that you're just pulling your thumbs most of the time. In the latter case, why don't you sort of start helping? You actually end up learning more that way. But in the former case, or like in many different ways, if your section isn't working for you, the schedule's going to be on the web, just go to a different section. Find one that works for you. Okay, you have license to do that. But I want you to give your section a good try. Because we do need them at the lowest sort of level. If I start to hear that one section has 25 people showing up, then I don't know, I have to change something. So. Okay? So that's the deal with workshops. It's not a place where problems just get done for you. You do them. You can change if you need to. The Society of Physics Students, we have a strong physics major, and
They enjoy helping students, so Monday through Thursday, 7 to 9 p.m., in the PAS library, the Physics and Astronomy Library, which is on the third floor of Bausch & Lomb, they will be hanging out and be willing to answer questions starting 9:15. Okay? So feel free to take advantage of that. They'll probably have set hours for certain people, so if you get a favor, you might find out what's going on. If you find that it's useful, you make friends and everything, you might be able to get some help outside of those hours, because they might not be too religious about adhering to it, but this is their commitment. Okay? Any questions on that or any other aspect of the course? All right, so last time I dragged you through the mud a bit, and we were looking at relationships between kinematic variables in one dimension. And we derived two formulas that basically follow from the definition of velocity and the definition of acceleration. Velocity being dx over dt, or delta x over delta t, and what we found was that if we want to know how far something goes and we know what velocity is as a function of time, we can take the integral of that between the two time intervals and we can determine how far we go. And it does not matter what the velocity is doing at that point, because you can have acceleration or not. Okay? Similarly, and this actually is not complicate things. Okay, we're doing one-dimensional stuff right now. Similarly, if you know the acceleration of the function of time and you can integrate that function, you'll get the change in the velocity over that time period. Okay? These are completely general expressions that are always true because they follow from the definition of velocity and acceleration. Okay, given these and given those relationships, if we assume that the acceleration is constant, then it turns out that we can derive four other equations that are useful. Each equation lacks one of the kinematic variables, so that means pretty much if you have any well-formed problem, you'll find one or more of these formulas will be useful for you in figuring out how to do things in the one dimension. We call these generally the constant acceleration equations. And although we haven't really talked about it yet, it's yet to come, intuitively a way to think about whether or not you have constant acceleration is whether or not the body that you're considering has a constant force on it. That constant force could be zero. If the force is constant on it, you'll have constant acceleration. All right? So I say that because in doing some of the problems that I think knowing that can help you sort of realize whether or not you have constant acceleration. At any rate, so here are the four equations, and basically you should just put them on your sheet and refer to them and figure out how to solve the problem from these as you go. What you will find is very often in problems, there are multiple ways in which you can use these four equations to get at the answer that you want. Sometimes the algebra is a little easier than other times, but if you see the solution has it a certain way and you did it a slightly more circuitous way or vice versa, it doesn't necessarily mean you're wrong. Okay, it's just using these equations in algebra. Sometimes you can find the time and use the time to get the position, but if you look carefully, one of the equations would have worked straight up to give you the position. It's that simple, okay? Oh no. Not good. Remember what I was doing next. I was going to start a problem. Part of the issue with the software I'm using is occasionally one of the pages that I prepared just doesn't load. So it was prepared and it's not loading, which really annoys me. So what I'm going to do is pick it up from a different page from a previous lecture, because that's where I've got had it set up. Sorry. I think we were doing a cat. Ooh, there's a cat. All right. So we talked about this a little bit last time. What we have is a cat in an apartment, and the cat spots a roach named Harvey. And at the moment the cat spots the roach, the cat begins to run past the roach. Okay? And the roach is just happily meandering, well, in a straight line, so maybe not meandering, but walking in a straight line at 1 meter per second, which is, okay, that's probably moving for a roach. So let's say Harvey is hauling ass to the wall. Okay, because Harvey spotted the cat when the cat spotted Harvey, and Harvey wants to get here into the no spot zone, which is sort of this crack in the wall. Okay, and we're going to say the cat starts from rest and is capable of accelerating and does accelerate at a constant 8 meters per second squared, which is pretty good. So it's a big apartment. Harvey sees the cat. Harvey is at 2 meters from the wall, and the cat is 10 meters from the wall. All right. And so the first question is: does Harvey live to see another day? If yes, you're done. If not, we're going to ask the question: where does the cat nab Harvey? Okay. So the strategy thing you have to see to realize how to do this problem, there are a few things to note. One is that you have literally two separate pieces to this problem. One is the one-dimensional motion of the roach going to the wall. The other is the one-dimensional motion of the cat going toward the roach and the wall. All right? And those two separate one-dimensional problems get tied together when you look at what the overall problem is, which is, does the roach make it to the wall before the cat makes it to the wall? If so, then Harvey survives. If the cat would make it to the wall before the roach makes it to the wall, then the cat's going to hit the roach before the roach hits the wall, and the roach is dead. Right? So you have the two one-dimensional problems, and then they have to get tied together. So there's that sort of large strategy piece, which you want to think your way through generally before you get started. Now, as we get into problems that are more complicated, there are going to be times that you're going to look at the problem, and that overall strategy just isn't going to jump out. In fact, it may look like you're missing something, that if you were to think what you need to do the overall strategy, you may be missing something that makes it look like it's impossible to do. So one of the things that I most want you to figure out how to do this semester is, in those instances, you have to sort of set it up and jump into it anyway. Which means you start to look at strategy, tease off the pieces that you think you understand, and you watch, you try to set it up and look at it.
And sometimes you'll find, for example, that piece that you thought you needed, you might put in as a symbol. You know it's not given in the problem, but whatever, I have to have it. And you put it in there, and you find that in the equations, lo and behold, that thing will just cancel out. And when it does, things will just fall out. But it may be impossible to see that from the start. And so one of the things that I really want you to get out of this class, if nothing else, is sort of the guts to jump off the cliff and start the problem anyway, even if you don't really see where it's going to go. But having said that, I want you to try to see where it's going to go from the start. So if you find yourself spending a lot of time trying to figure out how to get started and get frozen without really doing anything at that point, then you're broke. Okay. So one of the things you want to be discussing in workshop, for example, is the big strategy. And one of the things you want to worry about is if you're not seeing that strategy or how figuring out how to get started with the problem, that's what you want to do.
Alright, so to see if Harvey's going to live to see another day, one of the things what I'd like to do is to calculate the time of the bug to the wall and then the time of the cat to the wall. Okay? So, to see how long it takes Harvey to live to see another day, I sit and I look at the four constant acceleration equations because Harvey's moving with constant acceleration, so I know I can use them. And then I pick the one or ones that most suit my needs. There's no real magic to that. I don't have any great wisdom to share with you. You just look at them and see what you're given and you pick one that works. So in this case, I want to use this equation. And I need to do a couple of things before I can use it. So, for example, what is V0? For Harvey, V0 is 1. Is it plus 1 or minus 1? I've written plus 1, but that sort of depends on which direction I choose as the positive direction. I also have to choose my coordinates. I have to choose my coordinate system or something. I have to choose where is the origin and what is the direction. And once I choose that, I want to freeze it for the rest of the problem, and I want to be consistent with it for both the person and Harvey. Right? Or the cat and Harvey. So at this stage you have complete freedom. And it actually turns out that I have drawn on here, I've already chosen it, that I'm going to choose positive x, okay? Yeah, I wasn't supposed to write that. Sorry, I stole this from the... So I've written x equals 0, and the direction is positive. So sorry, a lot of what I just said sort of made me... I wasn't supposed to have those on there yet. So when you first see the problem, you may not have that, right? So you then have to choose whatever you're going to define as x equals 0. And you have to choose whichever is the positive direction. In this case, and you could choose the wall, you could choose going away from the wall is positive, doesn't matter. In this case, I'm going to choose x equals 0 to be the starting position of the cat. And you say, well, the cat's big. So what is x equals 0? And we're going to work in the approximation of the cat as a point for simplicity. Okay? So don't worry about the finite size of the cat unless the problem is worded in such a way that it makes it fairly obvious that you have to worry about that. Alright, so if we have the position and the zero position and the direction is positive defined, then we can actually use this equation. So x0 for the bug is going to be
8 meters.
So this is plus 8 meters. X, you want to know how long it takes the bug to get to the wall. So the final X is going to be X equal to 10, because that'll be the, in this coordinate system, that'll be the location of the wall. V0 is equal to 1. T you don't know. And the acceleration is 0. So now you can solve for T. It's going to be 2 seconds. Okay? So that's how long it takes the bug to get to the wall. So now to figure out whether Harvey lives or not, we have to figure out how long it takes the cat to get to the wall. And we can use the same equation. In this case, x0 is 0, x is 10, v0 is 0, and the acceleration, so we have 10 is equal to 1/2, and we said the acceleration is 8 meters per second squared times t squared. So we get that 10 is equal to 8 over 2 times t squared. And we calculate that t equals 1.6 seconds. So what's the deal? The cat gets to the wall before the bug gets to the wall, so the cat can get to the wall. Right? So then, since the cat gets to the wall, what I want to do is to ask, where is the spot on the floor? And I use spot a little figuratively there. Okay? So how are you going to do that? You don't know how long it takes Harvey to get to that spot, and you don't know where that spot is. So all you know is that the bug gets to that spot and Harvey gets to that spot. But I'm not quite sure what to do with that. Right? So this is a little bit of one of those where I look at it, it's not completely obvious to me how it's going to fall out. But I know that the bug gets to the spot, so I can write some expression for that. And I know the cat gets to the spot. And I can write some expression for that. And let's see what happens. So let's call the spot X sub S. Alright? So for Harvey, X sub S is equal to
That's 0 for Harvey, plus V0 for Harvey, times the time it takes Harvey to get to the spot, which I don't know, so I'm just using a symbol, plus 1/2 A of Harvey times T of Harvey squared. The acceleration for Harvey is 0. So that's 0. This I do not know. This I do know, which is the 1 meter per second. X0 for Harvey I know is 8 meters because he starts out 2 meters from the wall, right? So X0 here, this is 8 meters, so the same as we had earlier. And this I don't know. Okay, so that's hard to solve since I have two unknowns. But that's only part of the problem. So that is where the spot is where Harvey gets caught, as well as the amount of time it takes Harvey to get to that spot. Now we have to marry it to the other half of the problem, which is the same thing for the cat. So X cat final, which is, it's going to be equal to X0 for the cat plus V0 for the cat times T for the cat plus 1/2 A of the cat times T of the cat squared. T of the cat equals time for cat to get to the spot. Alright, and in this case, the acceleration of the cat is 8 meters per second squared. T of the cat I do not know. T of the cat I do not know. V0 of the cat is 0, so this whole term goes out. X0 of the cat is 0, so that whole term goes out. And then I have the final position of the cat. So again, I have two unknowns and one equation. And so now you have to marry the two together. The cat and the bug move starting at t equals 0, same amount of time when the bug gets mad. So T Harvey, the way I've used it here, and T cat, the way it's used here, are the same number. In addition, this is the position where Harvey gets hit, which is exactly this what this position is, because the cat and Harvey have to be at the same place for Harvey to get hit. Okay? So now you have basically these two equations and two unknowns. So from the problem, we sort of know that XS is equal to X cat final, the way I have it written, and T harv is equal to T cat. So the first equation simplifies to, all right, so I'm going to define this as X, and I'll define this as T. So the first equation boils down to X is equal to 8 plus 1 meter per second times T. So there's one equation. The other equation boils down to X is equal to 8 meters per second squared over 2 times T squared. the x's are, so we now have two equations and two unknowns. And I really hope you know from algebra days that if you have n equations and n unknowns, you can solve for them algebraically, the unknowns. So anytime you look at a problem and you set it up and you have two equations and three unknowns, that means you may be missing something that you need to think about, which gives you another equation. Unless I was in a particularly bad mood and gave you an impossible problem, which I won't say has never happened, but doesn't happen too often. And it wasn't that I was in a bad mood, it's that I just made a mistake. So, okay. So I have two equations and two unknowns. So we can solve for these. And a way to do it is to basically set this one equal to that one. So we have that eight halves t squared is equal to eight plus t. So that is 4t squared minus t minus 8 is equal to 0, which is a quadratic. Generally, I like to get it in the form where you have the squared term with a constant of 1. So I want to reform this as t squared minus t over 4 minus 8 over 4, which is 2, is equal to 0. So to remind you, this is in the form of a t squared plus b t plus c is equal to 0, and you can solve. You'll have two solutions to this problem, and you want to use the quadratic equation that you find. So this is sort of a general thing I just want you to remember. It may have been a while for you. T is equal to minus b plus or minus the square root of b squared minus 4ac. Is that right? Over 2a. Did I get it right? Yeah, okay. It's been a while for me, too. I assign them. I don't do them. So know this. I don't mind if you do it on your calculator, but sort of know what you're doing. And if you come to me and say, I plugged this into my calculator and it gave me the wrong number, I will laugh at you. The fact that your calculator gave you a wrong number because you punched something in wrong still counts as wrong. Now, typically, you won't lose a lot of points if it's this last bit piece in the problem if you have all the strategy and everything set right. But if your answer is wrong, even if the equations are right, you're going to get a point or two off. So. All right, so at any rate, when I do this, if I do the quadratic here, I get two roots, right, because you have these two signs, so you get two answers here. And what you find is that t is equal to 1.54 seconds, or t is equal to minus 1.3 seconds. And note that I did not write t is equal to 1.54632947781, which may be what your calculator tells you. That's why we did the significant figures thing. I mean, I'm not too strung out about significant figures, but cut me away. That's ridiculous. Just round it. But you don't want to round it to the nearest second, because you have clearly within this problem a lot more accuracy than that. Right? Within this problem, things are good to about a hundredth of a second, given the numbers that you've got. So that should be sort of what you pull with your, use with your calculator. So my TAs will be under instructions on the exams. If you put something like that, at least initially, they're going to put a laughing face to ridicule you. And maybe on exam two, they'll ridicule you and take a point off. Right. So I'm okay if you did 1.546 or whatever, but come on, don't be crazy with it. Think a little bit. All right. So at any rate, you get two answers.
They are both mathematically correct. They fit all of the equations. Which one's right? So that's the way it works. There is no mathematics that's going to tell you which answer is right when you do these quadratics. You have to look at the problem and think about physically what you're solving and what it means. And then that's your answer. Sometimes both answers will make sense in a funny sort of way.
Okay? So let me see if this makes any sense.
What the negative
probably means is that it may be something, I mean, sometimes you can usually think of something that does it. So I'm not trying to fly, I'm coming up with some, but sometimes it might mean if you look at the problem where they're both running the other way, there's a solution that also works that might correspond to the other route, besides, which may not be the case here, but if I can think of something that makes sense for this after I ponder it when I don't have all of you guys looking at me, maybe I'll write it on there here and post it. At any rate, what you find then is you choose the positive route, because it makes sense, since everything starts at t equals 0, it's going to be at a positive time when the bug gets caught. And the question is actually, where is the spot? So it isn't the time of Harvey getting caught, it's where. So in order to get that, I have to use one of these equations. That's the one. And so t is equal to 1.54 seconds. And I could use either of these equations because they both give you the same answer. So I'll use the top one. X is equal to 8 plus t. So the position is 9.54 meters. Okay? So that's where the bug gets caught. You alright with that? Okay. Hello. My machine has been uncooperative. Which is designed such that when it passes a certain point here, which I'm going to do very slowly, okay, it launches the ball straight up. It's also a cart that moves. Okay? So now the question is, if the cart is moving and the launch gets triggered,
What is the path that this ball takes?
So I have four possibilities up here for you to consider.
In one, the ball sort of flies up, slows down, and comes straight down. In two, the ball goes up and sort of slows down and goes straight down. In three, the ball just moves like that, sort of like a parabola. And in four, the ball just goes straight up and straight down. So this is the path of the ball from your perspective. Okay? So what I'd like you to do is to look at these four possibilities. Look deep within yourself. And I want you to think about which of these fits what you think would happen. Make a note of which number it is.
And now I would like you to close your eyes.
All of those who think it's number one, just raise your hand a little. Number two. Number three. Number four.
Okay, so you can open your eyes. So we got about zero of these. We got about, I don't know, 25 people saying number two. We got about 7 people saying number four, and probably about 50 people saying number three. All right, that's what we have.
So let's try it. This thing has a little electronic trigger, so when it passes this, it cuts the light of the photocell and causes the thing to trigger. So. What'd you see? Which one was it? Your angle. So. That's not even a choice. Alright. So we see number three.
Let's do a different example. So, let's suppose that what you want to do,
you're biomakers, right? Most of you? I say what you want to do is go out and shoot a monkey.
So, if that's your goal, here's your cute little monkey. And this particular monkey
has had brain surgery and has a metal plate in his head, which is stuck to the top of a tree by magic. Okay?
And you have a gun. And you have to aim the gun.
And it turns out that the thing on the top of the plate is how we actually do the demo. Let's just say this monkey is hanging from a branch. And when it hears the gun, and we'll say that sound speed travels infinitely fast, so it's at the moment the gun goes off, it scares the monkey and the monkey lets go. Okay. In this case, when the gun gets shot, electronically the magnet turns off and the monkey starts to fall. Alright?
So, then the question is,
you've shot a lot of monkeys before and you happen to know that they get scared and they let go when you shoot at them. Alright?
So, knowing this is going to happen, where do you aim? I'll give you a few choices. Let's say you aim up here. Say you aim straight here. Say you aim something like this or something like that. Okay?
I want you to think about which one you would do. In the event you want to shoot one. Under these ground rules, yes. Let's see. This will be the demo. It's a small monkey. It's a funky looking gun. It shoots a plastic marble instead of a bullet. So it's a little lame. Yes.
How fast will the bullets
go? How fast what?
How fast will the bullets go?
2 meters a second. Yes. How heavy is the monkey? Quarter pound. So I would like you to, and admittedly there's some estimation involved in this, so you need your best guess. So look at the possibilities, fix the one, the number that corresponds to the one you think you would do if you were aiming, and close your eyes. Who would choose number one? Who would choose number two?
1 second.
Who would choose number three? Who would choose number four? Okay, either my estimates are way off or a lot of you aren't voting. But I think you can get sort of the relative scale, roughly, of what the class thinks, all right? So, there seems to be a consensus that it should be number three. Coincidentally, we happen to have a setup here, and here's our bullet. It's a spring-loaded gun, and I can crank the spring, put this thing in. Oh, except I screwed up. Okay. I have to shoot this. Okay. What you'll notice is I have a laser aim. Fear the red dot. Okay, so right now it is aiming below the monkey. As it goes up, it misses the oh, there's the monkey. The monkey's got a red dot. I want to do a headshot. And this goes up above. So the consensus from the class is okay, on the monkey, on the monkey, on the monkey, sort of below the monkey, like so. You okay with that? All right, now that I've got an aim, I can load. Now I will arm it so that when it triggers, it changes the magnet as well, and the monkey has a metal plate instead of it start to drop the moment I trigger. Okay, arm it. What do you see? monkey, right? Okay. So it can't remember how to climb it. We got the ball. Now, this time, I am going to aim square in the middle of the bone. And they both happen independently. So, when we go through here, this ball does do exactly what it just did. It goes straight up and straight down in this dimension. At the same time, it's already moving this way, so it continues to move that way. There's no force on it in this direction, which means there's no acceleration, which means if it has a velocity that direction, it continues to have a velocity in that direction, unchanged. So the ball goes up while at the same time going this way, so you end up with the parabola, and it comes right back down in the ball, the thing, okay? So you can decompose this complicated two-dimensional motion into this motion, which is simple, and that motion, which is simple. Okay? Here we have sort of the same thing. We have an accelerating thing down this way. Both bodies will accelerate down because we have the force of gravity on them. They are both in the air for the same amount of time. So this motion is the same. Okay. In addition, we have a velocity that goes this way that this thing kicks out. All right. It starts with an initial velocity upward, but the change in it is the same as the change in the monkey. So it turns out that if you aim this directly at the monkey, they both sort of fall at the same rate. So velocity is changing in the same way, so that you end up with they end up the same place. But all right, it's a demonstration of sort of the independence of the motion in the two different directions. All right, so the message here is that you are now experts at one-dimensional motion. So we're now going to go to more complex motion. And the game is we decompose the complex motion into two or three dimensional, depending on what we're doing, one dimensional problems that we have to sort of marry together. Right? This motion is not so complicated. This motion is not so complicated, but they happen at the same time, and we have to figure out how to marry the two together so that you actually see the parabola, if you will. Okay? So that's where we're headed.
Now, before we can do that, we have to talk about what it takes to do that. So
what we know is that this motion differs from that motion by an algebraic sum. That's how we know which way it's going. This motion differs from that motion by an algebraic sum. So in one dimension, numbers are good. Because numbers, we can put algebraic signs on, so we have no problem. But when we go to more than one dimension, things get a little bit more complicated. Do we have any, budding thespians in here? Do we have anybody who knows what the word thespian means? Okay, we've got a few of those. All right. How about you two? Would you come help me out here for a demo? I was pointing at you, but she's cute, so that's fine. I'm on. Or maybe not. Depends on your taste, I guess. I'm not going to go there. All right, you are Elizabeth, and you are Anna. All right, so although you didn't raise your hands and tell me your best friends, I want you to do the whole acting thing and put your... You need to become what it is that you're playing. And Anna, you are a code. Elizabeth, you are a boat's motive. Right. And so what I would like you all to picture is that we have passing here the Genesee on a fairly rainy day, so it's going in a pretty good flow. Okay? So we have this river here. Anna, I would like you to be in the middle of the Genesee, or maybe at one side of the Genesee, okay? And you have no motor. You're sort of on the Genesee. What happens?
What's flowing?
It's flowing that way.
I'm facing this way?
Doesn't really matter. All right. So she moves. There's a force that the river puts on her. So she moves with the river. Not much she can do about it, okay? Now, thank you, Hannah. You can come back over to the middle of the Genesee. And now, let us suppose that this is a still lake, okay? And you're going this way, and you have a motor. What direction do you go? All right, you can power the boat now.
We're going this way?
Yeah, it's a calm, all right, you good? Now, come back to the start. Now it's not a calm river, I'm a calm lake. It is the Genesee. The Genesee is flowing this way. Hannah is aimed that way. What happens? Yeah. Right, you know what's going to happen. Suppose that Hannah's motor is pointing that way. That way. What happens? Yeah, maybe. Or if it's going a little slower. Or not. So she could be fixed in place. She might go upriver. She might sort of drift downriver. Right? Thank you. All right.
those have shown us is that life is complicated. Because we could describe this motion with a number and a sign. We could describe this motion of the river with a number and a sign. But you can't take two numbers and add them together and get anything like this. It's complicated. So we have to dream up something that is a little more complicated to deal with the reality that we face in nature. Okay? And it's not crazy. You're actually used to this. You've seen it before, or you can imagine it. Let's suppose you look at a weather map on the news, right? And it gives temperatures in all different places. And when you see your numbers, those numbers represent, you know, the heat at those particular points. So you can imagine the world being filled with these silly map points, each of which has a one-to-one correspondence with the temperature. And we would say in that case that we're describing the world with a scalar field, if you were a field theorist, you're a physicist, okay? A way to think about it, if you were describing the world with nothing but numbers. Every point corresponds to a number. But let us suppose you ask a different question. Suppose you now, instead of just wanting to look at something that can be described with simply a number, we want to look at something that is a little more complex. Let us suppose that what you would like to do is to go out and fly a kite or an airplane. So that what is relevant for you isn't what temperature. You don't care whether it's hot or cold, but what you care about is the wind, speed, and direction. Right? Now you can imagine the same thing as this weather map, but instead of numbers that correspond to temperatures, you would have little arrows. Those arrows, the direction of the arrow tells you the direction that the wind is blowing, and the length of the arrow tells you the speed with which the wind is blowing. And you can now imagine a weather map that has all these silly little arrows. And in fact, if you go look at some FAA website, you can find beautiful maps of this sort. Right? So now the world is a little more complex because every point needs more information. It needs a direction as well as a magnitude in order to describe it. And we call that kind of quantity a vector. And in fact, we need that because Anna and Elizabeth had to worry about, certainly in part, how fast the boat was going, so sort of magnitude, but very much what we saw as direction was very important. The motion that came out of this velocity coupled with this velocity depended on the direction of the two relative to one another as well as their magnitudes. Okay? So, if we want to describe reality with a mathematical model, it turns out that numbers are insufficient. We have to use things that are a little more complicated, so things that have both direction and magnitude. As you've seen, though, it's really simple to deal with one dimension, and the reason it's simple to deal with one dimension is you can't exactly use numbers with a plus or minus sign to tell you about direction. So it's algebraically very easy to deal with. Okay? But we now have to sort of develop an intuition or learn how to use a more complicated piece, which we call vectors. Because that's sort of the mathematical piece that we're going to use to describe things. So a scalar is just a number. I would say it has magnitude, but no direction. Okay. Well, okay, it could have direction. In a 1D problem, direction is given by the algebraic sum. What we'd like to do is to be able to do things in three dimensions. So it turns out that the kind of beast that we want to deal with is called a vector. And you can picture a vector as an arrow, if you will, in three dimensions. So an example of a vector might be something, if I imagine a three-dimensional space, you could have that be your vector, okay? Vectors have both a direction and a magnitude, which is really how they differ. So if you think about it, this vector, if you think about sort of, it's in a sense, relative to the origin, we can define this vector by this single point. I can say that the vector goes from the origin to that point, and that point being the end of the arrow. Okay? If I want to change where that point is, I change the direction or the magnitude of this arrow. Alright? Now, what does it take to define that point? What specifies that particular point? If I have axes, I call this my x, and this my y, and that my z, then that point is defined by a set of three numbers. Could be x, y, z, right? So far out in x, so far in y, and so far out in z. That determines where the point is going to be. So another way to say this is, in a three-dimensional world like we live in order to have something have direction and magnitude, I really have to specify three numbers. So instead of a single number with an algebraic sign, you can think of a vector as being defined by a triplet of numbers. Okay? And there are lots of different ways to denote that. We'll talk about mostly next time. But for a vector, if I have a number, I just write a number. I could call it a constant. I could give you a letter that represents this number. For a vector, we have to denote it as something sort of special because it has more than just a number associated with it. It also has a direction. So we denote it by a little arrow that's over. So this would correspond to a triplet of numbers, for example. And we're going to go do vectors out the wazoo next Tuesday.
Staple. I think the staple.
So we may do that.
Or write it on the the last page in the bottom.
We may do that. For the problems, you know, in the end, it's easy to just look on Blackboard, and it's just a document thing.
Yeah.
For the exams, I'm going to be more confident there. Actually, we'll have a list of numbers, because I'll be writing down, you know, what we made for each problem.
Oh, okay.
So there'll be a spot like this. Mm-hmm. So I was actually looking for special stickers to peel away. Or I thought about like lotto tickets and sticking something over and then scratch it away.
It's like, you know, law offices that stick those stickers that like sign here. They're made to be easily removed. I work in a law office.
So
maybe like a material like that.
I was thinking about it, but you know, what, since the exams are only four times in the semester, that there we go.
Yeah, I was trying to be like, my job this summer was environmental stuff, so I was thinking of...
Yeah, I'd like not to use the envelope.
Yeah, well...
Hi, thanks.
So, I got it wrong, but I just want to tell you about the thought process. I was assuming, though, that the friction of the cart is greater than it was. So in the case of, say, you did a shopping cart at a street versus decelerating at a decently fast rate, if you shot up from there, the ball would land ahead of the cart, right? Because that would be shooting from the velocity.
Right, but you're throwing something complicated into the problem.
Okay, but...
Yes, you can. And in the other pictures, so where it goes up and sort of slows down and drops, if you put air friction, serious air friction,
yeah,
the problem, you can argue that that's what happens. So I want you to learn to not let the...
Yes.
To not be unable to see the forest for the trees. In other words, assume it's frictionless. I tell you, assume no air friction unless I tell you it has air friction. And we will do problems where we have that kind of stuff. But if I don't specify,
that's right.
You know, in a sense, you have a new question. Does that friction or not? And I'll tell you. And usually, when I write the process, I'll put a lot of things.
So when I turn it on, you can stay here.
You don't need to feel bad if that's
what you're wondering.
Because of course that would happen. But we were working in the limit of no friction, of air friction, no wheel friction.
Okay.
So are you assuming constant,
The cart was constant, yeah. And to a good approximation, it was. It wasn't. Yeah, so that's why we had it on the nice wheels and everything. If I did a box, right, to slide on the floor, it would be exactly what you're saying. It just would go and... Of course, then it wouldn't matter.
Well, I'm thinking at the...
Because it would be going... Well, no, it would matter. If the velocity of the box is changing...
Yes, I'm saying.
Then the ball's going to hit. Because it's going faster here.
Right, cool.
Similarly, if you were shooting the ball in sort of an atmosphere of honey instead of air, and the cart continued to move, the ball's just going... So, yeah, don't make life complicated.
Okay. Sweet, sounds good. Thank you.
It's going to be tough enough without that.
Yeah, I bet.
But, yeah.
Also for the same demo, what about, like, considering, you know, where the ball goes?